we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, April the 28th, 2017. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by Elise Jacobson.
Hi.
Hi, Elise. Today is our cheese themed show. For our feature interview today, we have Dr. Neil Bernard on the show to talk to us about the evidence and facts when it comes to all the health issues and animal welfare issues associated with the production and consumption of dairy cheese. Dr. Bernard is the founder and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and author of numerous books on plant-based nutrition. And his latest book is called The Cheese Trap. Stay tuned to learn why cheese is the world's strangest food and why and how to break away from North America's number one food addiction. That interview is coming up in 30 minutes. And for our first interview today, we have local plant-based chef and cheesemaker Karen McCarthy here, who I am so pleased to have in person. On today's show, I have eaten Karen's plant-based cheeses years ago, and I can personally say that not only do they taste just as authentic as the dairy cheeses I used to eat, but they are even better because they lack the cruelty of the dairy industry, and you're just eating plants. Karen has a new book launching next week called The Art of Plant-Based Cheesemaking, and she will be here today to tell us all about it and how she creates her plant-based cheeses. But first, we want to talk to you about our own life journeys with cheese, because who doesn't have one, right, Elise?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, cheese can be a hard thing for a lot of people to give up. It is pretty addictive, and especially for those of us who live in the West, it can be such an important, or, you know, just a very omnipresent part of our diet.
It's a part of our culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what was your journey like growing up with cheese? Were you eating it every day like I know I was? I think I was anyway.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's sort of hard to avoid. I mean, if you grow up in the U.S. like I did, or in Canada or Europe, you know, it's kind of just on everything, especially in North America. So yeah, I think I was eating it just about every day. And we were talking earlier, like, you know, a number of years ago, right before I went vegan, actually, I was living in Germany, in Berlin. And obviously in Northern Europe, they're kind of all about their cheese, and you can kind of, you know, you can get lots of high quality dairy products there and that sort of thing. And so, you know, so that was, I think that it was one of the last things I gave up before I finally went vegan.
It actually was. I remember that was the last thing that I had to wean myself off of in terms of all animal products when I was going vegan. That was sort of my last allowance that I let myself still have a little bit of cheese. I let myself sort of wean myself off it over the course of a year.
Right.
Because I was addicted. Sure. And in our interview with Dr. Bernard later, we'll learn about the addictive effects of cheese, and it actually is, there is science behind that.
Right.
So what was it that encouraged you just to give it up?
I think more than anything else, it was just, you know,
it's
knowing
not the taste, it tastes good.
No, of course it does. Yeah. But I think just knowing how it's produced, just knowing where it comes from, you know, seeing videos of the dairy industry and, you know, these cows being abused and having their babies taken away and that sort of thing. And just in general being exploited for their reproductive systems, even in the best of cases. And I don't know, I just, the desire to not participate in that was strong enough that.
Honestly, for me, whenever I was tempted by cheese or when I was transitioning, I would think, like, in those last days, I'd be thinking, I have to do this for the cows.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who cares about what my, you know, what my palate wants, what my taste desires want, because back then we have lots of great commercial vegan cheeses right now available to buy. But back then there was nothing.
Right.
I remember there was one kind of soy cheese and it had casein in it, which is a dairy protein. So what?
And you know, it's really gross. if you tried it when you were vegetarian,
we won't say what brand it is, but there was only that one brand. But you, as I came to discover making our own cheeses and how fun that can be, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So how was that for you?
It was great. Yeah. I mean, a few years ago, Miyoko Shinner came out with her cookbook, Artisan Vegan Cheese. And that was kind of, I think it was the first of its kind, more or less, you know, just one of the first cookbooks for making these very fine nut-based cheeses, mostly nut-based. I think she has some that have different bases as well. But yeah, and I kind of got really into it for a while, just making my own cultured cheeses.
Yeah, were you making them all in the book like I was? I was like, I went from beginning to end, basically.
Oh, no, that's pretty hardcore.
She has so many different cheeses in there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, I made quite a few different ones, but yeah, I didn't make them all.
I've convinced omnivores with my cheeses Miyoko's cheeses, for sure.
Yeah, because they're lovely. They're genuinely really nice, and they're actually cultured, you know, like just like dairy cheeses, so you get that special complexity.
And we'll be talking about how that works with Karen later on. But, you know, if you're not into making stuff and your own cheeses, like I said, there's such a variety of commercially available cheeses out there now. And I'm wondering, what are some of your favorite cheeses that you can buy in the store?
These ones are a little hard to find in Canada, but Miyoko Shinner has actually come out with her own line of cheeses, Miyoko's Kitchen or something, and those are super lovely, and you can get them in the States, and I think you can get them from Vegan Supply up here, and see what else. Even like I know people have mixed feelings about Daya, but the farmhouse blocks are actually pretty decent, you know, for something that you can buy in a store. They're really
and apparently their shreds now are of a new blend that tastes even more authentic and better. So there's an article that just came out that I posted on our Facebook, I think yesterday, about that. If you want to check out Animal Voices Vancouver, it's all about the rise of Daya cheese, which is like probably the largest commercially available cheese in North America now. Right. And it's based here in Vancouver.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find there's been an explosion of commercially available vegan cheeses just over the last few years, and they're getting better and better all the time.
And
cheese is great, you know. There's and there's in the States you can get all these ones, Treeline and Kite Hill, and they're just very, very lovely. They make cream cheeses and that kind of thing too.
Yeah, and I just wanted to give a shout out for the book The Cheese Trap, which we'll be featuring later on. Dr. Neil Bernard wrote the book, but then he added a bunch of recipes at the end by local vegan cookbook author Drina Burton, who I love. She's one of my favorite cookbook authors, so I really recommend checking out the book, even just for the recipes itself. She has all different kinds of recipes that will substitute the flavors of cheese that you're familiar with. She has recipes for cashew cream, ranch dressing, sour cream and onion, cream cheese made out of cashews, a tofu feta and tofu ricotta, nacho dip, and a luscious fettuccine alfredo, and her cheesecake. And I've made many a vegan cheesecake before. You can't even tell.
Yeah.
Right? You can't even tell.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll be talking more about cheese soon.
This is your big chance, so don't blow it.
We're here to present the cutting edge radio you want to hear. What about a program featuring just local Vancouver bands?
No market for that.
We have an expert on gospel music.
No.
Our public affairs programs dig deep with voices other stations won't touch.
No.
Programs with First Nations hosts?
Sorry, no market for that.
We've got a lot of shows in other languages for people all over the world. Folk music?
You're kidding, right? Who would sponsor that?
Can't make big bucks with programs people want to hear? You have to go to Co-op Radio for that. Community-owned radio. Now at 100.5 FM. The switch is on.
All right, we've got a couple of events coming up this weekend, both tomorrow on Saturday, April 29th. First, from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Vancouver Chicken Save is having their weekly chicken vigil at the Hallmark Chicken Slaughterhouse. That's at the northeast corner of Hastings and Commercial. Join Vancouver Chicken Save in bearing witness and spreading the message of loving kindness, particularly for the chickens. And then right after that, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., also tomorrow, Saturday, April 29th, there's the vegan bake sale for Small Animal Rescue Society of BC. That's at Harvey Pet Food and Supplies in Langley. Come out and eat some delicious homemade vegan treats to help animals. All money raised will go to the Small Animal Rescue Society of BC to help with veterinary care, supplies, and food for their rescued rabbits, guinea pigs, rats, hedgehogs, mice, and other small animals. See the Facebook event page for more details. That's the vegan bake sale for SARS, or Small Animal Rescue Society of BC.
And if you have an animal-related event that you would like to have announced on the show, you can send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. Thanks for the events. For our first interview today, we have Vancouver plant-based chef and cheesemaker Karen McCarthy on the show. Chef Karen has worked in and around kitchens for the past 17 years in previous posts as director of food services at W2 Media Arts, executive chef at Gray's Vegetarian Restaurant, and at Zen Conscious Lounge, which is another vegan restaurant in Vancouver. Karen left Zend in July 2016 to pursue plant-based cheesemaking, catering, and teaching classes with her company, Blue Heron Creamery. Her new book, The Art of Plant-Based Cheesemaking, has just come out, and we are pleased to have Karen here today to tell us all about it. Hello, Karen, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, Allison. Hi, Elise. Thanks for having me here today.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on our cheese-themed show today, which is right in time for the launch of your new book, The Art of Plant-Based Cheesemaking. I know you've been working in plant-based kitchens for some time now. Can you tell us about how your journey led for you to become so interested in learning about the process of cheesemaking? And how did you come to learn to make your own vegan cheeses, since this is still a fairly new culinary skill that is not widely known yet?
That's a great question, Allison. When we opened Gray's Vegetarian, we wanted to put a charcuterie-style board or an antipasti board on the menu. And I didn't really like any of the commercially available vegan cheeses that were out on the market. So I began doing... I've been doing culturing and fermentation since I was a kid. So I began doing research to see what was out there in terms of information. I tried a few recipes that I'd found, and I wasn't super excited about their results. So I sort of took a little bit of what I sort of pulled out of the internet world and a few other places. And then I started looking at methodology from dairy cheese making and trying to crack open what the variables were there. So for me, it came down to identifying cheese as a process that is based on culturing a medium of some sort and then applying aging processes to it. And so that's when I began then essentially doing research at Gray's. And I ended up lucky enough to have a young chef from another restaurant stage with me for 6 months, 2 days a week, meaning interning, where we tested different ideas and different results and seeing what kind of flavors we could end up with.
Cool. So what was your cheese palate like before you started making plant-based cheeses? Did you have a lot of experience with tasting dairy cheeses in the past? And if so, how did that history affect the tastes and textures that you aim to achieve in your own making of cheese?
That is probably one of the best questions I've ever been asked, actually. because I'm allergic to dairy, and I have been since I was a child. So I became vegetarian officially when I was 12, and I've been vegan for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So there were periods of time in those years where I occasionally ate dairy, but I always suffered for it. Mm-hmm. So I haven't spent as much time eating dairy as some other people are, and I'm not as nostalgic about those cheeses as many of my customers are, right, or my students are. So for me, it became really about how do I create something that honors a tradition of craft practice, mm-hmm. and then understanding what role the cultures play in creating texture and flavor, and just wanting to make cheese that was good on its own, but without animal products.
Right.
So it's not really been an object of mine to copy, for instance, like things that we're familiar with in terms of cheddar style cheeses or those things. It's been, my goal has actually been to just create standalone cheeses that are good in their own right.
Cool.
So it's a little bit of a different process, I think, than some people have taken, but I don't feel nostalgic in that same way. So.
Oh, interesting. Well, that's so interesting, I find, because you're trying to replicate something that you've actually never tried before. Makes me think of David Isbister, our local vegan meat maker. He's never eaten meat, and yet he makes all these different meats.
That's
so
right. Yeah.
Kind of blows my mind. So I've been working this week to make a few of your cheeses. These are ones that they're not quite ready yet, but I had both of you taste test them, and you call them, they're not cultured because there were no probiotic enzymes in them. I do have experience with creating cultured cheeses in the past, but you're the expert, Karen. I'm wondering if you can explain for our listeners, what is the process of making your cheeses? What are the ingredients that you use to replace the dairy and the different roles that they play?
Such thoughtful questions. These are questions that come up in my classes all the time. So with respect to what we do in Blue Heron Creamery, we don't even just use cashews. We use a number of different nuts. And I'm starting to do some testing on legume bases. Because what I look at is what ratio of protein, fat, and carbohydrate do they contain? Because those are the elements in milk that create the different things that are cultured into the, when the cheese is cultured. So then after that, what I do, once I've identified the right sort of that component of texture, then what I look at is what cultures create certain flavors. So even if I'm using a Rejuvelac or I use water kefir, both are lactic acid forming culturing bases. So a set of microbes, usually of bacteria and yeast, that form lactic acid when they consume sugars in something. They will both yield very different tasting results. So if you take a cashew base and you apply Rejuvelac or you apply water kefir, they'll result in very different flavors. And that starts to tell us a bit about the story of what happens in dairy cheese making. Okay. The cultures do the work to create that variation in a lot of places.
Yeah.
So right now in vegan cheese making, we're primarily doing lactic acid fermentation, and that's sort of what the book focuses on. But I decide what base, and then what cultures, and then I decide what aging processes. So, am I going to brine it? Am I going to wash it with beer? Am I going to add flavors such as dried herbs? And then so it's a three-stage process.
And also, you say that you call the non-cultured cheeses cheese, C-H-E-E-Z-E, which I found interesting. That's the first time. This book was very exploratory for me because this is also new, and you're sort of defining what you're calling the art of plant-based cheese making. So I find that you're an innovator in this. Don't be embarrassed. It's true, right? You are an innovator. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what's going on around the world in terms of innovations of plant-based cheeses.
Thank you for calling me that. I am embarrassed. Only because this is such an exploration, and I come from a bit of a science background, so that's sort of how I approach things.
Cool.
For me, I needed to, when I was looking at, when I was asked to write the book, I had to think about, well, what are these things? In dairy cheese making, there's a common language. There's a vernacular and a nomenclature, so that basically if you said something like, that's a semi-soft washed brine cheese, any cheesemaker in the world would know what that meant in terms of processes, maybe what cultures were used. But in vegan cheesemaking, there isn't that common ground of language yet, or shared methodology, or things that are sort of popping up that have common ground. And so the book is sort of an intro to a second book that I'm working on that seeks to broaden that out a bit more completely. So that we can start maybe developing a craft that's focused less on copying things, but really identifying its own path. So I use cheese with a Z to help me when I'm teaching, and also to help myself, but to sort of say, this isn't cultured. Like, mm-hmm. this thing over here that we've made is an analog. So it has familiar flavors that are similar to. And I find that helpful in the sense that the biggest defining thing about dairy cheese is that it is cultured. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that does the work. So it's not about adding another thing to create a certain flavor. It is about the act of those microbes on that substrate. So following that line of thinking, and in terms of the complexity of flavor you can get from those applications, that's sort of what I want to do, is create, and keeping very much in mind that these are my definitions. They're not inherently anybody else's. I would never claim something like that. This was just a way of helping me proceed through sort of the movement of vegan cheesemaking, which has happened in a very different way than what dairy cheesemaking did. It's come from the ground up, very much DIY in the homes, and people, you know, seeking to create more compassionate alternatives to their favorite food.
Are all the vegan cheesemakers around the world, such as yourself, collaborating with each other to share ideas? Because you're talking about making a legume-based cheese. Yeah. I don't know if anyone's done that before, but perhaps a cheesemaker in France would like to know about that. Like, how do you share your ideas?
Well, it's funny enough, Instagram's actually been a really hotbed of, like, vegan cheesemaking secret background conversations.
Oh, cool.
I actually talk pretty actively to a number of folks. My friend Margaret Coons in Ontario has her company Nuts for Cheese, and she's starting to gain quite a lot of attention for her work there. I talked to Freddie, who's the head cheesemaker at New Roots in Switzerland, the folks at Happy Cheese in Germany, Artesia Tasmania, which is a company in Australia, Lori Williams at Cheese Hound in Williamsburg, New York, the lovely folks at Blood Coup in Los Angeles. And just from the names, you'll recognize that these are not the big players in the game. These are like the artisan craft cheesemakers who are really looking at evolving their own methodologies and practices. So, for instance, Freddie and I have been having a lot of conversations about, like, how to age almonds for a long period of time to get past a certain stage where they're quite awful and stinky, and not in the fun, good way. and we are starting to share with, we have to build a layer of trust with each other. We have our own companies, but where we all have an interest in seeing it grow as a practice. So that conversation's starting to happen, and we've been talking for a while about trying to get a group of us together, either in the internet realm or in a physical realm, to actually have an idea exchange.
Wow. Yeah. Plant-based cheese summit.
Yeah,
exactly.
Bunch of cheese nerds.
That's amazing. Yeah.
So that, just quickly, the two cheeses that I made this week, I didn't have a lot of time. So like I said, they're still aging. One is what you call the semi-soft cheese, not cultured. And it's, you suggested using jalapenos. I thought that would be really good. But what would also be good, because I've done this before, is I'm going to add peppercorns to it. And then I made another one that's supposed to be a hard cheese. It's not hard yet, though, because you told me that I need to keep aging it. It's only been like a few days, but it's getting there. And that's a smoky cheddar. So, honest opinions, what did you both think?
I thought it was great. Yeah. Yeah. They're really tasty.
Yeah. They're really great. And I love the peppercorn addition to the jalapeno. It's delicious.
And easy to make. Yeah. Easy to make. So there you go. So I'm wondering, Karen, what are some of your favorite cheeses that you make at Blue Heron Creamery? And how can people get their mouths on them?
So some of my favorite cheeses are the ones that take the longest to age, because I'm a bit of a science nerd. So for me, it's about a lot of things like patience and time. But our almond beechwood cheese, which we age up to about between 5 and 8 months, and then we wash the rind with a kelp stout, and then we smoke it, and we keep repeating that, and it ends up with quite a heavy density and a really strong flavor. We do have a blue cheese. I've been training cultures onto vegan mediums and then replicating them, which means I have a number of series of longer discussions to have with certain regulatory agencies about that. But where we've had some really good results, they're not quite ready to go public yet, but I feel like it's on the way. And then some of the cheeses that are more regularly accessible to our customer base, our smoke and truffle one, it's sort of a semi-firm cream cheese, and it's been really well received. So right now, most of our cheeses are accessible through a subscription base or an email pre-order. Because we age our cheeses, we release them two to three times a month. So we release the inventory as it becomes available. And so guests can go to our website and sign up for the mail list. We then say, hey, now it's available. Then they can self-select if they're in town and they want to get some. And we also do food service to a number of restaurants in town right now, including Field and Social. What's Up Hot Dog has our cheddar on their vegan poutine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's fun to work with those guys.
Yeah.
And then Watershed Arts Cafe is using our cheeses, including our almond ricotta, on some things. We have several more that we're soon to announce, but we're, you know, waiting to before we do that. And then we do pop-up shops, which we announce both on our website and on Instagram. And Instagram's really like the prime place to probably get the most up-to-date information because we update that really frequently.
So I just have a quick question before we go here is we've been talking about these cheeses as vegans, people, us three who don't eat dairy. But what is your feedback like from the public, people who you've been making cheese for quite a while? I had your cheeses when you used to work at Gray's. They're really good. But what does everyone else think about your cheeses? Do you have a large following in Vancouver?
Yes.
People have your cheese subscription, something I've never heard of before.
Yeah, it's like a you know, like wine of a cheese of the month club.
$35 a month. It sounds like I want to do it.
Yeah, they get, you know, you get 3 to 4 items in it, including some of our butters. Actually, we have over 500 people on the list now. And we most of them are not, strictly speaking, vegan or even plant-based. They are either allergic to dairy, lactose intolerant, food curious, moving towards vegan and plant-based. Mm-hmm. And because I do a lot of different events, including catering, and because of my history as a chef, I've been doing a lot of the galas that I've done. So we were recently at the Rare Disease Foundation Gala, and we were presenting a bite using our blue cheese crackers with some of our aged apricot Wensleydale. And for the first time at an event, I didn't say vegan first. I just let people eat it. People were like, that's delicious. That cheese is amazing.
Wow.
When I put the V in front of it, suddenly they're confused.
Oh,
so
okay.
We actually had to call. Some people were like, oh, that's cheese. I can't eat it. I'm allergic. We're like, no, actually, come back over.
Right.
You can eat this. This is fine. But it was a bit of a social experiment for us for the first time at a major event to see. And people's reactions were really favorable.
Cool.
So there's a bit of psychological work that goes on when you preempt something with vegan or plant-based.
Yeah.
People sort of start making up their minds before they try it.
Yeah.
You have a book launch that's happening next Monday, May the 1st at Cook Culture in downtown Vancouver. So if people are interested in going to that, it looks like for the price you get a book and cheese samples. It's like a wine and cheese event, right?
It is a wine and cheese. And it's actually at their North Shore location.
Oh, okay.
It includes a signed copy of the book. I'm making canapes for the event. I'm sending people home with a few recipes. And there's going to be like a sampling board of cheese.
Great.
With some Alderley Vineyards wine.
Oh,
and
lovely.
You also have some cooking classes or cheese making classes coming up, and I'm going to sign up, and so is a friend of mine right after this. So for more information on both of those events, you can go to our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and I have them posted there, and you can also find more info at our website, animalvoices.org. Thank you, Karen, for coming on the show today to speak to us about the art of plant-based cheese making and your book by the same name. To find out more about Karen's vegan cheeses, you can visit blueheroncheese.com, and you can, like I said, you can find out about her upcoming events on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. Thank you so much for joining us today, Karen. It's been lovely to have you here.
Thanks, ladies.
Thank you.
Bye.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
And now for the news. The city council of the second largest city in the United States and the capital of the entertainment industry unanimously voted on Tuesday to ban the exhibition of wild or exotic animals for entertainment, including circuses, other wild animal shows, displays in public areas such as on sidewalks or parks, and rentals for house parties or events. If you didn't guess, this is in Los Angeles. And the reform substantially builds on a 2014 policy banning the use of bull hooks to handle captive elements that was instrumental in causing Ringling Brothers to no longer use elephants in their shows. So that's pretty exciting to have LA ban the use of animals for entertainment. It's the largest city, by far the largest jurisdiction in the U.S. to enact such a ban. A 2015 Gallup poll found that 69% of Americans are concerned about the use of wild animals in circuses. And according to a November 2016 article in Forbes magazine, circus attendance in the United States has dropped an estimated 30 to 50% over the last 20 years. So that industry has really taken a hit and it's kind of dying. And in related news, the government of Guatemala also passed legislation in recent weeks banning the use of wild animals in circuses. And their ban includes foreign traveling shows and prohibits them from bringing wild animals into the country.
I just love this because people are starting to learn and take action in their countries and in their city jurisdictions. So just last week, actually, my sister lives in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and she had they had the Shriner Circus in their city for 4 days. Wow. And she attended her first protests there, actually, without me, so by herself and a couple of other animal dedicated people. And she actually they got a lot of attention, and a lot of people are for the circus in that area. Wow. However, she was able to go into the back and she took some videos of the elephants. It was really sad. There were three elephants in the back and they were displaying that behavior. What is it called, Elise? Is it stereotypy?
I think it's pronounced stereotypy.
Stereotypy, yeah. Exactly. And it was really sad. They were like swaying back and forth. And anyways, I'm going to post more info about that on our Facebook page. That video is going viral now, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. That's amazing. You've got some more news from us that's just been submitted today by Jeff Matthews. He's a local marine biologist.
That's right. Yeah. This is a statement from Jeff Matthews. I'm just going to read it here. This pertains to the recent Vancouver Park Board decision to disallow cetaceans from being displayed in Stanley Park. Mr. Matthews says, many of the claims of Vancouver Aquarium are purposefully misleading. There's a reason that they always refer to, quote, marine mammal rescue and not cetacean rescue. Because of the 1,500 marine mammals rescued in the past 50 years, only six were cetaceans. The rest were seals and sea lions. The public shouldn't be led to believe that there is an overwhelming number of whales and dolphins being rescued by the aquarium. The aquarium has also claimed that the cetaceans currently at the aquarium will need to be euthanized if the park board bylaw goes forward. However, their history doesn't support this. The last orca at the facility was moved to SeaWorld after orca captivity ended in Vancouver. That's pretty telling in and of itself. In the days after Chester, the false killer whale, was taken in by the aquarium, they noted that many aquariums and marine parks from around the world had called to offer facilities for his long-term care. So those animals there now could be moved to other facilities, or better yet, they could receive long-term care in a sea pen sanctuary. In fact, this is the option that the National Aquarium in Baltimore has decided to voluntarily pursue because they say it is best for the animals in their care. National Aquarium is the premier aquarium in the U.S., and just like Vancouver Aquarium, they do rescue and research. They have somehow come to the conclusion that they can continue their rescue and research work in a much kinder sanctuary environment. So it begs the question why Vancouver Aquarium refuses to consider taking the same steps and instead appears ready to euthanize these animals. So it's a power statement from local marine biologist Jeff Matthews.
Thank you for the news, Elise.
Our feature interview today is with Dr. Neil Bernard. Dr. Bernard is a medical doctor and adjunct professor at the George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C., and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, where he leads programs advocating for preventative medicine, good nutrition, and higher ethical standards in research. He has hosted three PBS television programs on nutrition and health and is frequently called upon by news programs to discuss issues related to nutrition and research. He is the editor-in-chief of the Nutrition Guide for Clinicians, a textbook made available to all U.S. medical students, and he has authored numerous books on plant-based nutrition, including The Power of Your Plate, Food for Life,
Dr. Bernard's program for reversing diabetes and power foods for the brain. His latest book is entitled The Cheese Trap, and today we have him on the show to speak all about cheese. Hello, Dr. Bernard, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Thank you. It's great to be with you today.
Well, thank you for joining us today on our cheese-themed show. You have recently written a book called The Cheese Trap, which delves deep into the numerous quandaries that stem from eating dairy and cheese. But cheese itself has its own special category in the spectrum of dairy foods. You say that cheese is the world's strangest food. Can you elaborate for us on that, please?
Yeah, you bet. Who would have thought it, that you could actually take this stuff? Well, first of all, although we all think of it as normal to drink milk and to turn milk into yogurt and cheese and so forth, Mother Nature never had this in mind at all. I mean, imagine, what are the odds that one animal would figure out to take the milk of a different animal or consume milk anytime other than during the breastfeeding time of life, during infancy? But at some point, when humans figured out how to make cows stand still, that was when people decided to take milk. And if that wasn't odd enough, then to turn milk into cheese, you have to do several things. You have to add bacterial cultures that creates that musty smell. Then you have to take the enzymes from the fourth stomach of a newly slaughtered calf and put the enzymes in that make it coagulate. Then you express out the extra liquid and add a bunch of salt, and that gives you this block of cheese. But this is the kind of product that is so much more complicated to make than eating an apple or baking a potato or something like that. And it's a weird thing that anyone ever figured to do it. Way back when, it might have made some sense because you could store cheese indefinitely and it's a hedge against starvation. But in modern times, it's basically a source of a lot of fat and cholesterol and sodium and calories.
And I think we have an addiction to it as well, because we North Americans didn't always eat a lot of cheese as we do nowadays. Can you speak about the history of the rise in the popularity of cheese consumption in North America? And what do you attribute the rising mass consumption to?
You know, it's really been quite a spectacular rise. A century ago, the USDA started tracking what Americans eat. And back in 1909, which is the first data we have, the average American ate 3.8 pounds of cheese in a whole year. It might have been popular in Switzerland, but it was not happening in Peoria. However, it started to rise in the post-World War II period, especially in the 60s, 70s, and maybe 80s. And that's really two things. It was fast food chains came in, and they were putting cheese on every burger, basically. And then pizza chains came in, and they were very aggressive with making that layer of yellow asphalt get thicker and thicker and thicker. But it's not just because they wanted to. The government was actively pushing dairy products in general and cheese in particular. The U.S. government promotes American agriculture, and the dairy industry has been a huge beneficiary of that, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to talk about cheese addiction because that is a real thing. You explain it very clearly in your book, and I know that I, for one, used to be addicted to dairy cheese. I think that many of our listeners, however, who enjoy eating dairy cheese may not be aware of its addictive properties. So can you talk to us about casein and casomorphines and how these opiates affect the brain?
Yes. When people get hooked on cheese, they think, oh, well, it's just the taste and the mouthfeel. And it's very salty, and it's very fatty. People don't think of it as salty, but there's actually more salt in typical cheeses than there is in potato chips, ounce for ounce. So the salty, fatty part kind of keeps us hooked. But the casomorphins that you mentioned, I think, are the really fascinating part of the story. When we digest the protein that is in milk, small compounds called casomorphins come out of the protein. They're encoded in the protein chain, and they come out, and they pass into the brain, and they attach to the very same brain receptors that heroin or morphine or Demerol or other narcotics would attach to. They're not as strong. The strongest of them has about one-tenth the binding power of pure morphine. So it's not as strong as illegal narcotics, but it is strong enough that a person eats some cheese, and they think, oh, isn't that nice? Let's have that again tomorrow. So there's some of it in milk, but the thing is, when you turn milk into cheese, you're concentrating the protein and the fat. So what was ever in the protein, what was ever in the fat gets concentrated. And that means that if there's a little bit of casomorphine in milk, there's a lot of it in the cheese. And that's why I believe that people may like milk on their cereal, but they get hooked on cheese and can't imagine living without it.
Right. And can you talk about what the actual purpose is of having opiates in dairy? Because if we think about it, right, milk is for a baby calf. So why would there be opiates in that?
What I think is going on is this is nature's way of underpinning the mother-infant bond. If a baby calf did not like nursing and said, "Mom, I'm going to wander into the woods for a few days, I'll come back on Thursday," the calf wouldn't do so well. And same with a human baby. And if you look at a baby who is breastfeeding, they have this look of tremendous intensity. And then they just collapse into sleep. And we think, isn't the mother-infant bond beautiful? Well, the child has just gotten a big load of casomorphins. And that could be the reason for the somnolence there. In other words, the casomorphins are mild narcotics, they're mild opiates, that I think of as being one of the underpinnings of the mother-infant bond.
Well, that makes sense to me. And I originally learned that fact from hearing you say it at one point, and I've talked about it on the show before because I think it's a really important thing for people to realize. You know, cheese is not, it's not just an innocent food. There's way more to it. So speaking of which, I learned from your book that most of the calories in cheese, about 70%, come from fat. And in fact, the makeup of cheese concentrates calories, dairy proteins, as you said, and saturated fat and salt. So I'd like to know more about how that works with cheese and some of the health problems that are associated with these high concentrations.
Yeah. Well, the first thing, obviously, is calories. When fat is by far the biggest source of calories, 9 calories in every gram of fat, and cheese is 70% fat. So that what that means is the average American consumes, believe it or not, about 65,000 calories of cheese every year. And I believe it's the biggest reason for childhood obesity. And the reason I say that, sugar consumption has been dropping for almost 20 years, but cheese consumption has been increasing, and we have clearly not conquered the obesity epidemic for adults or for kids. But there's one other thing. The fat part of the cheese is where hormones go. And the reason this is important is that dairy cows are impregnated every year to keep their milk consumption high. And pregnant cows make estrogens. And the estrogens end up in the milk, but when the milk is concentrated into cheese, that's where the hormones go. And it's really just traces of sex hormones that are in the milk and a little bit more in the cheese. But researchers in Rochester, New York, found that the men who consumed the most cheese had the most fertility issues. I'm talking about peculiar sperm morphology, lower sperm counts. And then what is most worrisome is that women previously diagnosed with breast cancer, those who eat the most cheese have the highest mortality by far, in a really good research study that came from California. So the traces of these hormones that are in cheese ought to be small, but we believe that they may well be biologically active. And what that means is a person might say, "Gee, I love cheese." But do you really want to feed this to your 7-year-old son or your 6-year-old daughter and be feeding them hormones that come from the cow? And they are a match for human hormones. And I'm going to argue that that's not something you want on your plate.
Right. And here in Canada, the bovine growth hormone is illegal. So we have advertisements saying no added hormones. Therefore, people think, oh, no hormones, which is not the case, is it?
Well, that's why they can't say no hormones.
Exactly.
They have to say no added hormones because the cow has been cranking out a lot of hormones. Whether you inject the cow with both bovine growth hormone or not, the cow is a living, breathing, mostly pregnant animal. They're pregnant 9 months out of 12.
Yeah.
A cow pregnancy is about the same length as human pregnancy. So, and if they're impregnated every year, 3/4 of their time they're pregnant, and they make, especially as they reach term, there's a lot of the hormone in their plasma and it gets in the milk. And it's enough that if you send it to a laboratory, you just send the pail of milk to a laboratory, they would tell you, they would know that this cow is a pregnant cow. And then that's what you're going to turn into cheese. But the answer is yes, that's what people do. And they unknowingly do that.
Well, not only is cheese consumption directly related to many ailments such as asthma, migraines, and rheumatoid arthritis, as you write about in your book, but there is also a connection to the top killers in North America, such as diabetes and heart disease. Can you tell us about the role that cheese plays in contributing to these life-threatening diseases in the body with regards to fat, cholesterol, and sodium?
Yeah, well, first of all, with regard to heart disease, dairy products happen to be the biggest source of what I'm going to call bad fat, saturated fat. So there's lots of it in cheese. Meat is the number two source, so meat is not, I don't mean to say that meat is health food. It's a problem too. But dairy products happen to be the biggest source. They're also very high in cholesterol. And although the cholesterol in the cheese isn't as bad as the fat, some of that passes into your bloodstream too, and it does add to your cholesterol level. And the more that you have, the higher your risk of not just heart disease, but also Alzheimer's disease. And then when it's inflammatory issues, it's not so much the fat, I don't think. I think it's really the protein. The dairy protein is one of the ones that people are very often sensitive to in subtle ways. So a person will have rheumatoid arthritis that magically improves or goes away when they get away from dairy. They have bad skin, they got asthma, they got allergies, they get away from dairy, and for many people these things just go away. So it's a good idea to get away from that. The hormonal issue, that's where we're worried about fertility problems and also cancer. And all of this, I should say, is the subject of ongoing research. But we know enough already to take this off our plate. We don't need dairy for any reason, and we're better off without it.
Well, Mother's Day is coming up, and dairy milk comes from a mother cow. Can you talk to us more about the process of the use of cows in the dairy industry who are impregnated and then made to give birth in order to produce milk that should be for their baby calves? How are the cows impregnated first, and what happens to these calves when they're born?
I have to say it's a pretty creepy process. If you were to visit a dairy, it's not the shining example of North American ingenuity. What is done on every dairy in Canada and the U.S. is that there's a farmhand who takes a glove that he puts on his left hand, and he puts it all the way up. The glove goes all the way up to his shoulder because he's going to stick his hand up that cow's rectum. And then through the rectal wall, he can feel her uterus. So picture this guy. He's got his hand all the way up to past the elbow. He's up her rectum. And she's not going to object to this because she's chained by the neck and she can't move. And then with his right hand, he takes what looks like a big, long knitting needle, and he puts it through her cervix and injects sperm that it was taken from a bull. And none of these animals are volunteering for this. Then they write a date on her flank. About nine months later, she does give birth. And this is what the dairy farmer has been wanting, because now that she's given birth, she's going to start making milk that he can sell. So she looks down at her newborn baby, and the baby looks up at her. And the farmer realizes he cannot allow her to keep her baby, because if he does, that is, you're not going to have milk to sell. So the farmer arrives with a wheelbarrow, picks up a baby, puts the baby into the wheelbarrow, and starts walking away. And the mother, this is her baby, so I don't care what species you are, this is the strongest bond we've got. And the mother starts following and will follow and try to stop the farmer from stealing her baby, which is basically what's happening. And then the farmer will eventually slam a gate in her face. And this happens on every dairy farm. And she cries all night long. And anybody who lives next door will hear this. And the mother's crying for a child, and the child's crying for the mother. And the farmer says, look, you know, I need the milk. This is my milk. And the mother has a different opinion about all that, obviously. The next year, she's impregnated again and again and again. And then by the time she's about four, the farmer's calculations show that he will make more money if he kills her and replaces her with her daughter, who makes more milk per unit feed. So every dairy cow in North America, virtually all of them, are killed around 4 years of age, something like that. But before that, they're impregnated every year. They go through the separation from their calves, and they're just used as machines. Many people who have seen this describe this as being uncivilized. And I'm a doctor, I'm not an ethicist, but I have to say that I agree. It's creepy. And I think if you know that the idea of breeding these animals and stealing their milk and making them go through this emotional turmoil just so that you can have your cheese or yogurt, which nature never figured you would need anyway, is ridiculous. And if you want calcium, get the calcium from green leafy vegetables. That's where it is. the cow eats grass and gets calcium from the grass. We can eat broccoli, kale, collards, Brussels sprouts and get our calcium. There is no reason to take it from a cow.
I think this is also especially interesting for the any lacto-vegetarians out there who don't eat meat because animals get slaughtered. Well, dairy cows get slaughtered,
too. They all get slaughtered, and before they get slaughtered, they just have to... The dairy industry is a meat industry. But before they get slaughtered, they just have to go through this process of impregnation and separation every single year until they're finally slaughtered. And by the way, that's true in India. You can take a country where people are largely vegetarian, and they have a huge dairy industry, and they will milk water buffaloes. And it's an enormous meat-exporting country because you slaughter them too. So the dairy industry is not, the cows are not happily giving milk and trotting along and, you know, licking the hand of the dairy farmer. It's an unpleasant thing to see.
Well, one thing you talked about in your book, after explaining this part of the industry, is you explained the actual process of milking the cows. And I wonder if you could convey that to our listeners, because this is something I actually didn't know. I've never been on a dairy farm before. I bet a lot of other people haven't either. So perhaps you can explain for us exactly how that is done.
Well, it's interesting. I have to say, if you go into some of the really big dairy farms nowadays, you know, because let's face it, you're getting dairy products for a huge market. I was in one not too long ago where the cows go one by one onto what looks like a massive turntable, and it can hold 78 cows all around the periphery of this big disc. So the cow goes on, slots in, and if the cow has a little bit of hair on her udder, they use a blowtorch and blow that off with a flame. And if she kicks or something, they'll just call that reflex. They'll say, no, cows don't feel pain. And then they hook up the milking machine, and it takes about 8 minutes for her to go around. And then she steps off, and they've taken her milk. And she will do that twice a day, or on some farms, three times a day. And they're just basically taking the milk that she was going to make for her baby.
Well, in your book, you say that we don't base our food choices on ethic and logic for the most part. If we did, I guess we wouldn't be eating cheese. You say we eat the way that those around us eat and prefer not to deviate from the pack. People love cheese. It's literally saturated in our society as our largest food addiction. So what steps do you recommend that people take who want to break from their cheese and dairy consumption and make themselves healthy and reduce the suffering to the animals? And perhaps maybe you can talk about, too, is how do you know if you're a cheese addict?
You know, that's a great question. People do kind of know it. And if you're having it every day, if you crave it, if you miss it when it's gone, if life without cheese seems unlivable to you, count it, you know, count yourself into
it. Yeah, I've been there.
Group. Yeah, I know. But however, here's the beauty of it. I wrote The Cheese Trap because I wanted people to know about the hormones and the cholesterol and all these things, and the ethical part too. But I wouldn't have called it The Cheese Trap if I didn't have a way to get you out of it. And there are so many great things to eat nowadays. So what I first encourage people to do is at least just know how getting it out of your life can help you. Once people understand that it's the easiest way to lose weight, to help with hormonal issues, to help with their joint pain or asthma or whatever, that's job one. Then the second thing is take about a week and try all the wonderful things that can take its place. So instead of feta on my salad, I can put a little bit of avocado. Instead of a cheese pizza, I'll have a pizza where I put a little extra sauce and the olives and mushrooms and artichoke hearts and use nutritional yeast, which is my secret weapon. Has no fat, but it tastes just like cheese, and you sprinkle it on, it's delicious. And I have got a fettuccine Alfredo that was made. Adrina Burton did all the recipes for the Cheese Trap, and she is just
amazing. Yeah, we know her.
Okay, well,
she's from Vancouver or White Rock.
Adrina is great. She's fantastic. And so try the fettuccine Alfredo, or try, we've got a cheesecake without a drop of dairy in there, and it is out of this world. So anyway, my hope is that people will try these things, and instead of thinking, I'll never, ever have another more cheese, you're going to have non-dairy cheeses, And there are also commercial ones to try. For example, if you get Kite Hill cheese, which a lot of places sell.
That's some of the best cheese ever.
Well, it's made with a typical cheese-making process, but they start with almond milk instead of dairy milk. Or Tree Line, which is made from cashews, or Miyoko's Kitchen. There are so many, and they are great. So you're going to get all the pleasures, none of the guilt, none of the regrets, and it suddenly becomes a fun adventure, and your weight is dropping before your very eyes. You're feeling better. Your energy is rebounding, and it's just a cool way to go.
Well, thank you once again, Dr. Bernard, for coming on the show today to speak to us about the many truths about cheese as written about in your new book, The Cheese Trap. For more information about this book, you can visit thecheesetrap.org. Also, if you liked what you heard in today's interview, you can hear more of Dr. Bernard for free at the Online Food Revolution Summit, which starts this weekend. He is speaking on May the 5th. Maybe really quickly, you can tell us what you're going to be talking about at the Food Revolution Summit.
We are going to be talking about all the things that people can do to, well, first of all the things people didn't know about what's in their food, and then how to get healthy. Because even though I do want people to be concerned, I want to open their eyes a little bit and open their hearts even. More than that, I want to pump them up and make them feel like there is an easy path forward and a fun one. And that's really
yeah.
good.
This is a great event, and I've heard you speak at it before. So you just have to go to foodrevolutionsummit.org to sign up. It starts this weekend. Thank you so much for coming on the show once again, and have a great day.
Great. Thanks a million.
You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us here next Friday, May 5th. Next week is Puppy Mill Action Week, and we'll be discussing and learning all about how we can help end puppy mills for good. The show next week will feature interviews with Paws for Hope and Pets OK BC. Don't forget to visit our website at animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows or download them as podcasts. And now we'll leave you with a song. Here's Ivory King and Jonathan Mann singing The Truth About Dairy Cows.
And I just need to give a profanity warning for it. At the very end, there is some swearing, and I do believe it's justified. It's very much in context with what we talk about here on the show. The swearing comes from video footage from a Mercy for Animals hidden camera investigation that happened 3 years ago at a dairy farm in Chilliwack, British Columbia. And just 2 weeks ago, there have been now 20 charges laid against the company and 7 workers. So one of these people you'll hear at the end is one of the workers. They have pled guilty. Chilliwack Cattle Sales has also been fined close to $350,000.
Wow. Okay, thank you for listening to Animal Voices today. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, and remember to be kind to the animals.
I used to think if I didn't eat meat that I was doing my part. I couldn't give up cheese and dairy, and I didn't see why I should start. After all, cows always give milk to be enjoyed by me and you. I never stop to question whether or not that is true. But now I know that dairy cows get pregnant just about their entire lives, artificially inseminated, moving and lonely wives,
giving birth every year, baby cows just taken away, and that's how you get your cheese each and every day.
Cows, cows, they're just mothers without the children.
Share their mama's fate, they too will be dairy cows, pumped full of hormones, starting at the age of 1. They normally live to 25, but 5 years of this and they're done.
Cows, cows, they're just mothers without the children. Cows, cows, they are crying out to find them, and it all happens over again, over again.
But what about her sons? They got no milk to give, so
this system. Well, they got no right to live. They are just a thing left over, wasted life into a meal. When they end up on a dinner plate, 'cause someone ordered veal.
Cows, cows, they're just mothers without their children. Cows, cows, they are.
Couldn't get her in the parlor. We beat the fuck up. I mean, I drunk that cow in the barn, baby, and I beat that fucker till her face was like this big around.